Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our third session on C.S. Lewis with Dr. Lou Mitchell. It's been a wonderful series, and we want you to come back for the fourth session, but I'll remind you that it starts an hour earlier at 8:45, but there will be coffee by 8:30 in the Welcome Center. So prepare to bundle up and get out because you don't want to miss the last session. And now Lou will open us with prayer.
Testing. I guess I didn't push the button. So did you hear the prayer? I don't need to do it again.
They heard the prayer.
Good. I'm sitting down today. I'm not going to be jumping around like I usually do. I've been fighting something off all week, and I'm losing the fight. So I came very close to canceling this morning, but I wanted to be with you guys. I'm reshaping the course a little bit because I bit off more than I could chew. I mean, it's one thing to think about you're going to give a lecture, but it's another to get involved in conversation. But conversation is so important. So today we were supposed to start the fantasy literature, but there's an important work before we get to there that we have to take a look at. And I will mention that to you in just a moment. But next week, we will be looking at Narnia, if you want to read on ahead, Aslan and the White Witch and all of the characters. And I think we'll probably let that bring an end to the series. Now, if I were to ask you what do you think is C.S. Lewis's most significant teaching book for Christians? What would you say? Anybody? Somebody said you read it when I asked you the first week. I can't hear.
Surprised by Joy.
Well, Surprised by Joy is a good choice. That gives us the intellectual side of his development. No, I'm thinking of Mere Christianity. Do you guys know that work? Well, Mere Christianity is a work that is probably his most popular work. Let me see if I can get some stats here. I know that it was voted by a poll by Christianity Today, ranked first among 100 books that had a significant effect on Christians in the 20th century. That's pretty good, don't you think? That's very good. By 2016, it had sold 3.5 million copies in English, and I think that's gone way up since then, and it's been translated into at least 36 languages. So it is certainly a significant work. In fact, it's so significant that there is a biography about the book. This is a series that comes out of Princeton University Press, and it's a book about certain books. So George Marsden, who is a well-known in some circles historian, taught at Duke and Notre Dame and a little bit at Harvard, retired now, wrote this. He wrote the definitive biography of Jonathan Edwards. We mentioned Marsden last year. And it's very interesting, the significance of any book, to have a book written about it. What's also significant about the book Mere Christianity is that Lewis didn't just sit down and say, I'm going to write a book on this topic. During World War II, he was asked to do a series of brief episodes for the BBC radio, and they gave him a time of, I forget what day of the week it was, 7:45 to 8 p.m., but there weren't popular programs scheduled around it, and it turned out to be a terrible time. So, but beginning on August 6, in 1941, he did a series of five episodes. Well, he was asked to do another set a little bit later, and they gave him a better time on Sunday, 4:45 to 5 p.m. Now, note that these are just 15-minute episodes. And so what he did was he basically gave four themes that each were published as an individual book. So you can see this little book has four books in it, four sections we could call it, but he but as they came out they were published separately. In 1947, The Case for Christianity was published. Then two more set of talks were later published separately. The broadcast talks themselves resumed again in 1943. In 1943, he published Christian Behavior. 1945, Beyond Personality. 1952, all of the books were published together. It is, if you haven't read it, I would strongly encourage you to read it. The phrase Mere Christianity, Lewis borrowed from a 17th century British Puritan by the name of Richard Baxter. You may not have heard of Richard Baxter, but he has written kind of a classic book that pastors study, but also church historians study, called The Reformed Pastor. That's the name of the book that he wrote, among many others. And it actually talks about calling on people in their homes and catechizing them. Okay, folks, the minister's coming to your house a week from tomorrow, and you got to know the Westminster Confession inside and out, because I'm going to report back to the session on how you're doing. Well, again, remember, these were the Puritans, the English Puritans. Richard Baxter's book, this one, Mere Christianity, was a book about basic Christian teachings. And that's what Lewis went to. He used the term mere Christianity because he wanted to make it clear that he wasn't pushing any denomination. Okay? He himself grew up Irish Presbyterian, but he became an Anglican and was part of the Church of England. And what he wanted to do was to talk about kind of the core ideas of Christianity. And so that's why he wrote this. Let me see. He starts out the first set of talks about morality. A lot of them were about morality. And he emphasizes right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe. He says there is such a thing as the law of nature, that all people knew it by nature. They didn't need to be taught it. Now, what he's getting at, theologians may call general revelation, that is, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God. That's kind of the one thing. But he's more after, I think, what we would call conscience. That everybody, he says there are some basic givens in human nature, that there is a sense of knowing that there's a right and a wrong. But there's also a sense that none of us keep with that standard of right and wrong. Two facts for foundation to this, the universe we live in. All humans believe that we ought to believe certain ways. Did you follow that? There's kind of an ought behind us that we have a sense of. Now, it might not be totally sophisticated. It might be, you know, again, he's talking about all cultures, all times. You know, that there's a right and a wrong, and that we do not obey, we do not keep that law that we know. Then he starts to talk about, given this fact of nature, is nature all there is? In an earlier book, we talked about this, the Book of Miracles, and in his own development, you might remember, was it last week we talked about that or the week before, that he, at one point in his own development intellectually, he was a naturalist, okay? He believed, and this was real big at the time at Oxford, he believed that the world of matter is all there is. The only thing that matters is matter. You got that? Yeah. The eternality of matter. Then he started to develop that many go beyond that and think that there is something beyond matter. We have a sense of it. All cultures have had a sense of it. You know, some sacrificed virgins and threw them into the volcano, or they, you know, they sacrificed to the god of farming, or you know, having children, or whatever. That there was something that was out there, that a couple of things was beyond nature, and to which or to whom we were responsible for the ought of how we should act. You with me on that one? That there's something out there, a life force or something, okay, out there in the world. I think it was Immanuel Kant who said two things I'm sure of: the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. Well, that's something like that. There's bits of evidence that somebody is behind it all. Now, that varies. And the how that evidence is accepted varies. But most theologians would emphasize that there is what we call natural religion. Or general revelation. There is a revelation that is general in that it is generally available to all, and it only gives us a general knowledge about God. If you read Romans 1:18, that gives you a good sense of what general revelation is, that God has made God's self or himself known. God has taken the responsibility of making some of him known. Enough that, as Lewis said, we have a sense that there's something to which we are responsible. There's something beyond the ought. Paul would even say that we know we don't keep it, and we know that there are consequences. The Apostle Paul would say that. But the two bits of evidence are the universe he made and the moral law that God put inside of us. Christianity tells people to repent and promises forgiveness, but can say nothing to people who do not feel they have any need for forgiveness. Lewis is arguing that we all do, but we may not acknowledge it. You with me on that? You with me today, guys? Okay, good. This isn't exactly...
You would never know you were not feeling well.
You would never know that?
You would never know you're not feeling well.
Thank you very much.
You put on a good act.
Thanks. Well, this stuff isn't the most exciting stuff either. It's kind of like lecture time, and I would much rather interact than lecture, but there's content that I want to make sure we get through. In the second set of talks, What Christians Believe, Lewis tells his readers that he's been asked, that this is the topic he's been asked to talk about. One thing he says not to believe is that all other religions are simply wrong altogether. He's talking about Christianity. And what he means by this is, he kind of hinted at this when he was talking about joy and myth and these kinds of things, that all religions contain some of the truth. Not the big capital T truth, but they all point some way or other to the truth. I mean, even the virgin being sacrificed in the volcano still has the truth that there's something out there, that there is a being or some type of God, or even polytheism where there are many gods, teaches that there's something beyond this world. And so he says that all religions have and the way joy functioned for him at the very end, he says, joy is a signpost. Joy isn't the end of the destination, but joy points me in the direction in which I should go. And he talked about that joy became less important to him after he became a Christian, because he says, if you're lost, man, and you see the signpost, you rejoice. But you don't just stand there and look at it and, you know, ponder it. You haven't arrived yet. You've only been to the place that points you to where you're going. So joy for him was a pointer to where you needed to go. Mythology, he said. This is what Tolkien helped him see. All of the ancient myths function in the same way. There's a kernel of truth in them. They point to something. They're not the something, but they point to the something. He said that people believe different things. He started talking about some people who believe that there's some kind of God, and people believe that there isn't. He talked about pantheism. He became a pantheist at one time. Does anybody remember what pantheism means? Can we break it apart? Yeah, you got it. You're going like this. I think you got it. What is it?
Everything, worldliness.
Well, it's important that it's the whole world, but what is the world? Pan, all, theism, God. Yeah, come on, don't be shy. That was good. I mean, you're in route. Come on, you got it. Yeah, go ahead.
The world is God's body.
Yeah, the world is God. The tree, that's God. It's God's body. That's right. So that he was, Lewis at one time was a pantheist, and there are those pantheists in the world. God is the universe, and therefore the universe is God. It's interesting. It's kind of like materialism, in that we say matter is all that matters. Matter is all there is. And one step beyond that is, all there is God. Well, the universe is God. Atheism, he thinks, is too simple. If the universe has no meaning, how would we ever find out that it has no meaning? That's his argument. If there's no light, no creatures with eyes to see, dark would be without meaning. Let me move on from there. Then he talks about the shocking alternative. God gave us conscience so that we would know right and wrong. He sent good dreams. By that he means myths that point the way a little bit. He selected a people to especially reveal himself to. Who's he talking about there? The Jews, the Old Testament. And the real shocker is that a man, a human being, claimed to be God. The incarnation, he talks about in his book Miracles, is the miracle of miracles. That God would become human. And in this, we have one of the most often quoted parts of mere Christianity. It's this. It's called the trilemma. I mentioned this in the first class, but you're not required to have remembered it. Lewis says this: I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. Now think if you've heard this, by the way. I'm coming out of C.S. Lewis. This is me talking now. This now I'm back to Lewis. Here's the shocking thing. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Now it's me again. Have you ever heard that? Okay. I won't ask if you believe it, but you've heard it. And I wouldn't be surprised if that is the kind of working theology or philosophy that many of us have today. You know, he's one of the great moral teachers. That's actually what Islam teaches, that Jesus was a prophet, but he certainly wasn't the Son of God. Okay, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, here's the trilemma, on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg. I like that. I'm a poached egg. No, you're not. Or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either he's a lunatic, a liar, or he really is who he said he was, Lord. They're the three L's. Lunatic, liar, Lord. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Okay, I want to break here for just a minute and respond. Talk to me. What do you make of that? Again, that is probably the most popular item that's quoted among people who are trying to give a defense of the Christian faith or the uniqueness of the Christian faith. Kathy, go ahead.
Well, the first word that comes to my mind is atheism, or people who are atheists.
Yes.
And so I think, are you familiar with Frank Turek? He's a current.
No, I don't know that name. T-U-R-E-K.
Well, he was interviewed recently, and I found a book in the library, but he goes, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. In other words, that's the title of his book. So it's like, how can you prove or disprove something that you don't think even exists?
Yeah, yeah.
That's always been the...
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, atheism is not God, so how do you prove how do you prove something that isn't there?
Yeah.
Interesting, okay. Anybody else want to comment about especially about the trilemma? Do you remember what the trilemma is? I think the choir's going, I hope, or else I've offended any number of people, which is not uncommon. What's the trilemma? Christ is either lunatic, liar, or Lord. Yeah, that's received. Some say that that's really a good argument. Some people we call apologists who are giving defense of the faith have used that. Others say it's not really ironclad, and I don't know the criticism of it. I've just read that not everybody accepts, you know, the trilemma as being quote unquote gospel. You know that it is. He goes on to say that we are told that Christ was killed for us, that his death has washed away our sins, and that by dying he disabled death itself. That is the formula. No, he's trying to get at mere Christianity. That is Christianity. That is what has to believe, to be believed. He says all the other theories, theological theories, are secondary. Now let me read it. I'll read that again. He's saying, here's mere Christianity. John R.W. Stott wrote a book, you might have seen it, called Basic Christianity. That's all about basic doctrines, but Lewis goes beyond that. He says this, we are told, and this is what he thinks we absolutely have to believe, to call ourselves Christians, that his death has washed away our sins, and that by dying we are told that Christ was killed for us, that his death has washed away our sins, and that by dying he disabled death itself. That's the formula. That is Christianity. That is what has to be believed. We know, he goes on to say, no one can be saved except through Christ. We do not know that only those who know him can be saved through him. See what he's doing there? He's saying, we know that one can only be saved through Christ, but we don't necessarily know all that that means. Can Christ save someone who doesn't know him? Does Christ only save those who know him? Those are, in a way, doctrinal statements, but the basic theology he's arguing is that we know somehow or other Christ is necessary for salvation. And then he says this, now today, this moment is our chance to choose the right side. We're going to have an altar call here. God is holding back to give us that chance. It will not last forever. We must take it or leave it. There you go. That's the end of book two. Questions so far? Yeah.
Why couldn't God just forgive everybody? Why would he need Jesus?
What would Lewis say? Because we're all sinners. Because all of us have violated the law of God. All of us have broken God's law, and we need forgiveness. He said that at the very beginning, that these are basic human principles. We know there's a God. We know there's a standard. We know we've broken the standard. Right out of Romans 1. And Paul would even add, not only do we know that, but we rejoice when we get other people to believe what we believe in it, to act the way we act. That's what Paul says at the end of Romans 1. We're not going to argue it now. I mean, that the point he's making is how that's worked out. He said that's doctrine. And he says doctrine is less real than the basic core of teaching. Like everybody is going to be saved, is going to be saved through Christ. That's the core. The view of the atonement, of which in history there are many, and in The Lion and Witch in the Wardrobe, we'll find out next week, he puts forth one particular one called the ransom theory. That's all secondary. That's the how this is worked out. But the most important stuff is the this that goes across all denominations. Okay? He uses the image at the beginning of a hallway. Okay? Or let's view your pews as doors in the hallway. And, you know, the Methodists are in that door. The Presbyterians are in that door. The Catholics are in that door. What he says he wants to do is he wants to get everybody out in the hall. He wants everybody to meet. And what he says is, these are the core things that we all should have in common. And then the Presbyterians go off and they teach predestination. And the Methodists go off and they say you shouldn't drink alcohol. I don't know if they still say that. They used to say that. The Catholics say, you know, you've got to be baptized. They have the seven sacraments and all that. He would say that stuff is less important. The room you're in is less important than being out in the hall together. Okay? I like that imagery. Now, you don't have to buy that, but that's what he's after. He's after mere Christianity. It's Christianity for sure. It's about Christ, who is either lunatic, liar, or Lord. And it's about salvation or whatever, fulfillment through Christ. How? I don't know. Different doors say different things. But the core is this. In the book Christian Behavior, he talks about the virtues. There are what we call the cardinal virtues, which are kind of general. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's 5 cardinal virtues. Anybody take a gander at what they might be? You don't have to. I'm going to go home if you don't, but no, it's okay. They are prudence, temperance, justice, fortitude. Sorry, there are 4. 1, 2. Yeah, cardinal was the one up there. Prudent, what is prudence? I'll tell you what he says. He says prudence is common sense. Temperance is all pleasures in moderation, not abstention. mind you. He's not pushing an ascetic Christianity where you go and live in a cave and deprive yourself of everything, or on a flagpole. This one guy did. But you have all things, all is open to us, but in moderation. That is temperance. Again, not abstinence. Justice is fairness. Fortitude is courage to face danger and the ability to endure pain. He has a discussion about these. I'm not going to give a lot of content. But then there are three theological virtues. What do you think? Now, come on. We're in a church here. Yeah.
So I have a question about the four that you already mentioned.
Okay, the cardinal virtues?
Yeah. So it seems to me that prudence is in direct conflict with fortitude.
Is in direct what?
Exists in direct conflict with fortitude.
Why?
Because to be brave in the face of adversity is sometimes imprudent. It will result in harm to you and others.
But if it's World War II, isn't it prudent and making common sense to send an army to Europe to defeat Hitler?
How prudent was it for who's our friend? Bonhoeffer to try and kill Hitler. How'd that work out for him?
Didn't work out great, but I thought it was a worthy try.
Yeah, so that was fortitude, but not terribly prudent.
Common sense. Okay. Well, I'm not going to argue with you. Yeah, that's an interesting statement. That the virtues can kind of compete with each other or nullify each other.
I guess the reason I get stuck on that is because people are so skilled at rationalizing virtually anything that they could. It's very easy to say, well, it's just not prudent to stand up against that.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we have to decide whether that's common sense or not. But common sense as a virtue is, I think it's a pretty good thing. I mean, if we take the non-identification words, we're talking about common sense, pleasures in moderation, fairness, and courage, or the ability to endure pain. What are the three theological virtues? Come on, people.
How about...
What? Faith, hope, and love. There, I knew we could get that one. He calls it charity, which is faith. Agape is the word. Interestingly, Lewis writes a book later in life. You know, he's a linguist. It's called The Four Loves. And he says there are four Greek words for love. When you say love, and you're talking Greek, you've got to identify which love it is. One is storge, one is eros, one is philos, you know, Philadelphia, and the other is agape. And he uses the imagery, I have used this in weddings, where he says lovers, you know, eros, they stand face to face, absorbed in each other. But the love of friendship, you stand side by side, facing the world together. I always like that. Take that as you will. Okay. He has a section on Christians and psychoanalysis. He says Freud made a direct contribution to Christianity. Okay. But he prefers Jung. In fact, he loved that song, You Make Me Feel So... No, never mind. That was a different thing altogether. Jung. He says, people judge by external actions, but God judges by their moral choices. Every day, we have the opportunity to make countless choices. And this is a significant idea now that pervades Lewis's works. Every day, We have countless opportunities to make choices that are slowly turning us into heavenly creatures or hellish ones. Quote, each of us at each moment is progressing slowly to one state or the other. You follow that? And this is what he says in some other places about that. This is a very significant concept in Lewis. He says this. This is in the preface to The Great Divorce. Some of this comes right out of The Great Divorce. But what you ask of Earth? He says, Earth, I think, will not be found by anyone to be in the end a very distinct place. I think Earth, if chosen instead of heaven, will turn out to have been all along only a region in hell. And Earth, if you put second to heaven, will have been from the beginning a part of heaven itself. What he's saying is that the life we live now, we're heading towards our ultimate destination. In the sermon, The Weight of Glory, he says this. It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses. To remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature with, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship it. Later on he goes, there are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal. And their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals with whom we joke with, or it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors, H-O-R-R-O-R-S, or everlasting splendors. Next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. Let me read some more about this concept, because this is a very, as I said it, more than once, probably don't need to say it again. This is from The Great Divorce, which you guys studied a while ago. He says, Milton was right, says the teacher. The teacher is George MacDonald. He's the one who leads the narrator, or the one who leads the guy, which we identify as Lewis, ultimately, through the bus trip to the outer districts of heaven. Milton was right, says the teacher. The choice of every lost soul can be expressed in the words, better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. There is always something they insist on keeping, even at the price of misery. There is always something they prefer to joy, that is, to reality. You see it easily enough in a spoiled child that would sooner miss its play and its supper than say it was sorry and be friends. There are only two kinds of people. This is from The Great Divorce again. In the end, those who say to God, thy will be done. And those to whom God says in the end, thy will be done. All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find. To those who knock, it is opened. Two things there. We'll start with the latter one. God gives us free will. And God allows us to make the choices we make. But there are consequences to our choices. Our choices every day have an effect on us. And our choices are actually molding us in one direction or another. What Lewis is saying, the other, is that heaven doesn't start when we die. It starts here, now. We're moving towards it. In the same way, hell doesn't start when we die. It begins with the choices we make now. We are becoming who we will be for eternity. Comments? Questions?
Yeah. So does that mean that Lewis doesn't particularly believe that God has infinite power to redeem everyone?
Well, interesting. He talks about God's omnipotence in relation to suffering. And he comes away looking at, basically he affirms God's omnipotence. But part of God's omnipotence is that he gives us free will. Out of God's omnipotence. We don't have free will because God is weak. We have free will because God has given us, created us in his image, God's image, with free will. Okay? Any other? Yeah.
If we all sin, which we do, is it a basket, the weight of justice? We do more good things than bad things. But if we're setting our own destiny and we all sin, how do we prepare ourselves for heaven?
By focusing on Christ. That's what he would say. Remember, he said that earlier. That's a key point. Anyone who's going to be saved is going to be saved through Christ. How that works itself out, different people say different things. But when that core, we can say. What he said was, he was arguing, does that mean that everybody, what about people who don't choose Christ? Can they be saved? And he speculates there's no reason why they can't. But when they are saved, they'll be saved through Christ. Maybe, you follow that? That kind of reasoning? They may not choose Christ. That doesn't necessarily mean Christ doesn't choose them or still work grace. He's not a universalist. He does not affirm universal salvation. He's Christ-centered. He is Christian in these core beliefs. Anybody else?
Can I make a comment from the ceiling?
Please.
I'm online.
Who's speaking? Oh, you're online.
Doug Mitchell.
Okay, hi.
I'm just wondering, it seems as though almost every one of the points you've made in the last 10 minutes have to do with whether or not we're willing to believe that God truly loves us and that the extent of his love can go beyond our understanding. If we can define how much God loves us, then we are choosing not to fully believe in God.
Because his love, yes, God is greater. God is greater than our thoughts about God.
Absolutely.
That's what you're saying. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And so therefore, who are we to judge, especially who are we to judge whether or not a non-Christian is allowed to enter the kingdom of heaven? We're stepping in front of God when we do that.
Yeah, that's right. I agree.
We're not granting him the power to do what he wants to do.
Well, we can't know.
No.
Anybody's heart except our own.
But that also goes to the point of who's the boss.
Yeah.
Are he we makes the boss or is he the boss?
Yeah. Well, which room are you in?
Well, I would say that humility is a mandate eventually.
Oh, of course.
Because when you come to the gates.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You're out of options.
Okay. Well, interesting you said about loving God. Lewis says we are not created to love God. We are created for God to love us. So he does really emphasize the love that God has for us. Okay, unless there's more or you wanted to say something else, sir,
no.
I'll move on.
Nope.
Okay, thank you. He does talk a little bit about sexual morality. He talks about chastity outside of marriage. He quotes Augustine, where Augustine said, God, make me chaste, but not yet. That's St. Augustine. He does say he's very traditional in his role on Christian marriage. He does say there are two types of marriage, as in his own life. There's the marriage of the state, and that's like a contract between people. And then there's a marriage that is before God. And so that's what his was. He talks about forgiveness, but he is a just war theorist. In other words, if we have enemies, it might be necessary to kill them. He says this, all killing is not murder, any more than all sexual intercourse is adultery. Okay. The great sin, what do you think the great sin is? With all capital letters. There's five of them. Five letters, not five sins. We said it earlier. Who was saying about humility earlier? Were you saying that? Somebody was saying that. What's the opposite of humility? Pride. He says pride leads to every other sin and every other vice. Pride is a state of mind that is anti-God. Okay, that's the great sin. Pride leads to every other sin. Let's see if I want to say anything about the theological virtues. Charity is covered under forgiveness. Do you remember the What Would Jesus Do? Do you remember that story? Have you read the story about it? It was serialized, and it's about a minister who somebody comes to him needing help. He refuses to give the help. The guy goes away and dies, and the minister has this radical like conversion where he wants to judge everything by what would Jesus do. That's how it begins. It's in the late 19th century. It was serialized. It's a book that's worth reading. I mean, you can read it now as a book. What's the name of the book? It's not What Would Jesus Do? I don't know. You can look it up. Look it up on your phone. Okay. He said, the Christian asks, not what would Jesus do, but the Christian asks, quote, if I were sure that I loved God, what would I do? Then do it. So he tosses it on its head a little bit. Not what would Jesus do, but if I were sure that I loved God, what would I do? And then go and do that.
By the way, it's In His Steps. Was the name.
Oh, that's right. Exactly right. In His Steps. It's pretty good. It's a good book. Since Christians didn't think much about the other, where am I going here? With hope. Oh, he says this: creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist. For example, we get hungry. That means there must be food. We're almost done. It doesn't mean that we will find food, but because we get hungry, there must be food. So what he's saying is about the desires we have for joy and the desires that we have that are not fulfilled in this life must mean that there's another life in which they will be fulfilled. Yeah, make that what you believe. Faith has two aspects: what we believe and entrusting ourselves to God. I think that's maybe all we have time for. There is a book 4, which is Beyond Personality, First Steps in the Doctrine of the Trinity. And in that one, he has one of the other most repeatable lines. Let me see if I can find it. He says this: the Son of God became a man to enable men to become the sons of God. That's a pretty good one. I think that's all we have time for, folks. Now, next week, we're going to look at his fantasy literature. And there's the Space Trilogy, but we're mostly going to talk about Narnia. And you're going to be really surprised at how Narnia has come to be interpreted. See you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for being here.